Okay, this is Bob Dobbs here with Scott, and this is session number 17, recorded on September 18th, 2006, and we're on page 29 of my book, Vatican Communion with Bob Dobbs, and we're back into the McLuhan section, the McLuhan column, which is on the right side pages of the book. We just did a lot of LaRouche last week. We're on session number 17. This first quote we're going to do is from McLuhan's executive newsletter called the McLuhan Dewline Newsletter, and it's volume 1, number 7, put out in January 1969, and the article is called Vertical Suburbs Are High-Rise Slums, and Scott will read the excerpt from that report.
Physically, the young seem to feel that the planet has become their stage.
And feel is in italics. The young seem to feel that the planet has become their stage.
They want to act outside, in the street, on the campus. They have shifted their dramatic quest for new identities away from the expression of private opinions to the enactment of a new kind of group theater. The new program they offer for scrutiny and participation seems to many people to be trash, such as never has been seen before. A wild orgy of, quote, law and odor. Which material for the hypothetical probe that the satellite environment offers the planet itself as a new kind of theatrical stage is to be found in the Walker Report to the National Commission on the Causes and Preventions of Violence?
Yes, and this was in the first page of the article, Vertical Suburbs or High-Rise Slums. If I remember, I think it was a fold-out sheet, sort of like a big newspaper page printed on both sides. I think that's the way it was laid out. In the McLuhan Dewline newsletter, he would put the newsletter in all kinds of different formats, experimental formats. In the tradition of his book, Counterblast, which came from Wyndham Lewis's Blast of 1914. Okay, so what, this is pretty obvious to me what the quote says, but what do you make of it?
Well, this idea is familiar to me. I know that when Sputnik went up, that created the what Marshall referred to as the Perennium Arch, this theater...
Proscenium Arch.
Proscenium Arch, yeah. Now we had cameras... Cameras were looking down at us, and the world became the stage. He believed that the reason why the hippies were acting out and dressing up in costume and doing their hippie things were because they out in public with the flowers and all that whatever was all kind of like subconsciously everyone knew that they were actors on the stage.
Okay, so he takes here the phrase, the dramatic quest for new identities. So always young kids in through history have to form a new identity in relation to their surroundings, create some kind of identity. So that eternal pattern, the dramatic quest for new identity, has a new expression. He's saying that the literate generation, say, of his generation and back into the 19th century, the dramatic thing was to form a unique opinion, a private opinion, a literate scan. And, you'd have artists and people like Oscar Wilde, they'd get famous, get media coverage in their day back in the 19th century because they had weird ways of saying their opinions, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was logocentric. It was verbal-oriented. But here he's saying that young people feel. They're inside the TV extension of tactility, and then the theater complex, the theater effect of the satellite complexifies that. So they feel that the whole globe, the whole terrestrial artifact, what we call first nature, is the content and therefore a stage for acting out their drama. And McLuhan had a phrase for the hippies and yippies and those kind of counterculture youth movements of the 60s and early 70s. He called them the international motley. Everybody was putting on a clown suit. And, of course, that's what younger kids look like to the older radio generation, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like he says, the new program the young people offer for scrutiny and participation seems to many people to be trash, such as never been seen before. a wild orgy of law and ordure. So it's not law and order. Ordure means garbage. Law and garbage. And part of the garbage, what McLuhan called the garbage apocalypse, is that the kids would scrap images and clothing from any culture in history and put it on. It's like the British invasion, you know, the mods, they wore stuff from 19th century, sort of aristocratic 1890 stuff, I think. And then there was the fad for Indian, Native American, Hopi costumes, you know. People were grabbing costumes from different eras. The British retrieved the 19th century fop, flanner look, and the American kids adopted the Native American look. Mm-hmm. All of them trying to mime some kind of role, right? Mm-hmm. And the role was that all youth transcending national linguistic barriers were all in the same boat, and therefore the international counterculture formed with rock music as its bond.
Mm-hmm.
So the interesting thing he talks about, the young seem to feel. See, the new generations always feel the vibes of the ground. And then he says, rich material, and so they're acting out. They're not that articulate, but as Tom Wolfe's novels and books pointed out, the kids would express what they felt through a new kind of slang, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And some of his books would feature the slang, you know, as a major feature of the writing. Then he says, rich material, these effects, for the hypothetical probe that the satellite environment offers the planet itself is a new kind of theatrical stage. And rich material for the probe that the planet is surrounded by a new environment, making it an art form or a theatrical stage. So the rich material comes from the American government's Walker Report to the National Commission on the Causes and Prevention of Violence, which came as a result of the summer of 68. The riots in the Democratic Convention in Chicago, the burning down of cities in 67 and 68, even going back to the Watts riot in 65, those issues were what the government was supposed to make a report on. And, you know, sort of like a report on the Katrina hurricane kind of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. So the causes and prevention of violence, and that came out, I think, in the summer of 68, fall of 68. So McLuhan's writing and commenting on its inability to see the big picture in this January 69 newsletter. So if you understand McLuhan, listening to me a lot, these are familiar statements.
Mm-hmm.
This is not too hard of a quote. And we could say that, in relating to the cliche archetype stuff we talked about, the international motley would ransack clothing styles from all through histories, you know, cliche clothing styles like the Hopi Indians, and retrieve them as new intensity to act out the dramatic quest for an identity. And that's retrieving a cliche as a new archetype. Right?
Right.
Archetype being a way of establishing a private quest of an individual identity, which is more highlighted in Western literary cultures. The tribal cultures, the kids are exiled from the tribe, and they have to go out and fend for themselves, and then they come back a man, right? You know, that cliche about how tribal pre-literate peoples force the kids to grow up, to go on a dramatic quest of an identity by going out and having a vision, right?
Mm-hmm.
You've heard of that.
Yeah. But they were under the, you know, at least they were under the protection or oversight of the elders, you know.
Right. Now, this was a totally decentralized thing. The nuclear family was already weakening in the late 50s, early 60s, and so there wasn't even any guidance, but that did not, the kids didn't feel that they were not being guided, because they were felt they were guided by the rock idols and the group feeling among the baby boomer generation all around the planet.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, everybody traveled to Europe and all over the place, South America. It's a generation on the move, the now generation. What's interesting is that the idea of going on a vision quest was not really what a literate generation did in the 19th century. They would like scan knowledge or new art and try to come up with new opinions or new unique points of view. It was like an head experience. Whereas you can see, if you think of the tactile sense and the proprioceptive sense and this inner guts reality that TV was an extension of, the inner central nervous system, the kids retrieved the vision quest of tribal societies, preliterate societies, and that was expressed by the sudden interest in swallowing all kinds of drugs, marijuana, LSD, to heroin.
Right.
And that was a way of getting an internal vision question, not a way to get a unique opinion.
But the trip was largely programmed by the media.
What
remember, Tim?
No, I didn't get the first word. The trip was
programmed.
What's the trip?
The acid trip or the psychedelic trip. There was all. By the time, I mean, you know, when Huxley first took the acid or some of these early guys, they didn't know what to expect. They didn't have a lot of preconditioning. By the time the hippies were taking acid, there was psychedelic poster art. You already kind of like knew what to expect, or at least were programmed to expect.
Yeah, that was due to the Ken Kesey acid test. So the media playing up Ken Kesey in 64, 65, 66, by the time your generation came along, 67, early 70s, that's where the images came from.
Yeah.
And then the rock culture and the Beatles and Dylan and everybody. It was a mixed media thing. It wasn't just drugs. It was a sense of involvement. But the inner senses had to be enhanced by drugs, but the other senses had to be enhanced too. So you had high volume music, you had high volume eyeball stimulation, the whole mixed media thing. And remember, all the media were the content of the satellite environment as well as the planet. So you had a mixture of first and second nature, kind of fusion, airsats, you know, not a cold fusion, real fusion like cold fusion energy, but it was an anticipation of it by the fusion, just as Finnegan's Wake expressed. McLuhan said we had a fusion of art, media, and science in the 60s. And that's what the kids were miming. And what's interesting is that my chart shows the different spirals in the 70s and 80s for people as they tried to adjust themselves to the mechanical environment of the older electric environment. They had to develop roles. Then you had all that stuff of the merger of the 60s spun out into different niche marketing. You had New Age literature. You had the Terence McKenna kind of literature. You had business literature. You had Holder's Catalog. You had computer nuts, you know, computer innovators. All of them were sort of specializing in one of the particular spirals that was just one big blur in the 60s. They become strings, like in the string theory view of the world. As I show on my chart, Rye, Eloy, Two, and Lofty, the strings are the spirals as people explored God, sex, politics, and consciousness. That was a way of reasserting the chemical body back into your particular culture after you were stoned on your vision quest, which would probably lead nowhere other than a shared consensus that you were part of something that was happening.
Right.
And then you had to relate that back to older media environments, which were bigger than anybody's revolutionary desires, and how to modulate the older environments and your new identity in relation to that was only dealt with by McLuhan.
Yeah, but there was also the whole corporate aspect behind it, you know, the commercialism, the advertising, the guys who were the psychologists and trying to figure out how to craft that into the fear of our desires, and you know, in order to sell us, you know, plastic goods.
Yeah, that was the consumer environment of the first half of the 20th century, adapting to the new situation, and they saw that lifestyles, niche types, straight, hip, not hip, you know, conservative, right wing, left wing, all these things develop magazines and consumer products to go with a particular image that fit into the commercialized landscape that America had become in the first half of the 20th century, but was superseded by the abundance of just watching TV. And so when you talk about advertising, it's just fitting it back into the literate kinetic industrial structure of people having a role of possessions and buying things.
Mm-hmm.
That was the commercialization of the counterculture was just a translation back into America, into its media landscape, media cliche environment, which you can't get rid of.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you have a massive collective understanding of what's going on And that's why McLuhan said the satellite solar government had to program the environment. So you had different cultures went through different manifestations of fitting the global effect back into their culture. So you had the Red Brigades and the terrorist guys in Europe. You had the SDS in America, but they soon died out. And over the 70s, the American mixed media environment, which was the most advanced environment, began to dominate all over the world, even to the point where China capitulated. And what was his name? Chu Enlai, or the guy that came after him, forget his name. They got rid of Mao Zedong in 76. They got rid of his wife and her buddies, the Gang of Four. And by the late 70s, they started to merge with the American archetype, which was the only identity they could have, while American kids were identifying with the barefoot world of Asia.
Mm-hmm.
Like the beatnik started,
yeah.
Like going over to Tokyo and Alan Watts and the Zen world. So you have this interesting...
We were all being programmed by the unfolding of these events, but nobody was programming the events. They just were all... It was like the weather changing or something on us.
No, the program... As a matter of fact, I was going to send this out. You know how Women's Lib began with a character, one of the yippies, Keith Lamp, and one of the radical women in 68 in New York City asked him for a cameraman. I'll have to look that up. A cameraman or something to come to a demonstration by a bunch of New York radical leftist women against a American beauty pageant. And, yes, Keith Lamp had all these magazine people he had access to. And he got them to show up, and they took the photos and got the media coverage of these women. And maybe they were burning their bras, I'm not sure, but they were protesting against the American beauty pageant. And that was, that media event was what's triggered off the Women's Lib movement. So who caused that? A bunch of people in New York City. But the ground was there. Women were ready to feel their theatrical role, at least of the baby boomer generation, to assert their chemical body identity, because everything was decentralized and not within the nuclear family model anymore. So there was room for black power, for youth revolt, for women revolt. All of it was actually acting out the American dream of asserting your private identity and your private opinions, private lifestyle. Now, when you say you're programmed, it gets complicated. You've got the programming of news, which keeps everything safe so that it doesn't panic the people about different issues. In 68, you had the Robert Kennedy assassination, so they weren't going to panic people about any conspiracy around that. You had the Martin Luther King experience, an assassination. So those things, the content is programmed for American society, just as other countries were programming their news events for a sense of stability. But the larger effect of the satellite could not be controlled by anybody. But allowing it to continue to happen and the chaos that came from it would have been understood by intelligence agencies, you know, which I was part of.
Mm-hmm.
So there's older media. They're programming the environment by insisting on people continuing to eat meat and drink milk and buy cars, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they have lobbies within the American structure that funds money to them and keep their industries going. And a lot of Americans, they went to their hippie be-ins by driving in a car.
Well, in the sense that like a day trader knows how to profit from the stock market, whether it's going up or down, how did you, working in intelligence agencies, learn how to profit from the way in which the media environment was manifesting?
As I lay out in Up the Orphan Ante, the role of the tetrad manager was to know that there'd be enhancements, retrievals, obsolescence, and flip points, and that it was unmanageable. But the chaos it created allowed us to remain comfortable. Those that were in bureaucratic, powerful positions, either by their knowledge or by their wealth, they were able to, as McLuhan said, we have the quote in here earlier, Big Brother goes inside. We were no longer a problem. We didn't have to hide ourselves because there was too much going on. As McLuhan said, the baby powder gets in the eyes of the new man being born, the new child being born. There was just so much chaos going on, we could carry on without any public attention. And when there was attention on that kind of stuff, which began with Watergate, it was targeted on local politicians.
Mm-hmm.
So So the, but you know, it was, as you see in my diaries, the my father and others were aware that the whole power of human management was weakening, and what I'd say the Android meme was taking over. Nobody was in control anymore, and so merchants and businessmen and different programmers on lower levels would just look for new markets and keep the money machine going by making sure they had products from those new desires and fads to be sold.
Mm-hmm.
But for the big picture, the big world that young people were trying to change, they had no clue that there was no fulcrum point from which to change the world. The world was being changed by itself. And so you program the cliches, the stereotypes, that there's a White House and there's a presidential election and there's democracy. Each culture programmed itself to reassert its stereotypes and cliches. So that's another meaning of cliches becoming archetypes, as a way of providing an anesthesia or security for the psyche, who would normally find it pretty hard to deal with a world of chaos. Now, you can look in other cultures, like the less advanced cultures in South America. What happens in the 70s? They get dictatorships and death squads. China loses its Mao and Marxist roots. All these huge cultures all over the world were going through incredible changes, just like America was, in their own particular developmental phases context, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it was a world of chaos. That's why I have on my chart, McLuhan as the image chaos in his quadrant.
Mm-hmm. So they didn't have the televisions and the two cars in every garage in these third world countries that were...
They had their tribal identities. You had the peasants rising up and demanding their agriculture. And you had just new industry coming in. So the industrial capitalists, using flight capital, suppressed the peasants or killed them, murdered them. And there was it was much like Nazi Germany in the 30s and 40s. So when you bring in a radio environment, you're going to get what happened to Europe in the 30s, you're going to get that in later cultures that got radio, and that was Latin America.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have TV like we had it in America. They're mainly a radio environment. And so they had the tribal paranoia of class warfare of a radio environment that Europe had in the 30s. And a lot of the, it's May Brussels tract, or a lot of the Nazi networks of World War II got a lot of employment in the 60s and 70s in South America. One of the key images is Klaus Barbie, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then you have the computer world coming in the 80s, and then that changes that dynamic, and then you have people like Klaus Barbie get arrested. And then you have the American Mafia gets arrested. So there's even more shifts going on when the computer environment supersedes the, we'll call it the digital Android meme environment, supersedes the effect of the radio in the Middle East and in South America.
Mm-hmm.
Or in Africa. Africa just collapsed. Remember they had their freedom, their autonomy, and decolonialization in the late 50s, early 60s? But it could not keep up with the speed of a computerized economy in the 70s, so it was recolonized by flight capital. So the dream of establishing a nation in Africa was just too obsolete. You know, there just wasn't enough time, enough stability to do it. I mean, in Brazil and South America, they had nations and relatively industrialized, but even they couldn't maintain a kind of stable public space. So the paranoia came in, and they created death squads. Now, they had in Africa, it's not as developed, so it's going to try to be a nation, but it's going to try to get a beachhead for each African nation or even the Pan-African movement. Those movements have no ground to move into, because the economy was being globalized, Android memeized, digitalized, which had no paper money structure. See? So you just review a couple of these things. I'm just making inventory. The big picture is total chaos. So the way we, at the highest levels of intelligence, managed ourselves was, hey, we stayed on the sidelines and laid low and allowed the bureaucracy among themselves to fight. So it kept us comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
So even that was wearing out by...
So knowing what was going on.
Let me just say, since even that was not able, you were not able to be hidden on that level by the late 80s, early 90s. And the symbol of that collapse is Prince Charles as a factor in the Secret Council of Ten and the Solar Government. And that's when I came in and wrapped it up and put it away.
Mm-hmm.
So what were you going to say?
I don't know. What I was going to say just got superseded when you mentioned Prince Charles. I thought about Lady Di. Why was she taken out?
Well, she wasn't. That was an accident. But the projection that she was is something we'll talk about later. You know, why is conspiracy such a popular mode of looking at things? Actually, by the way, I'm going to be on Ebon tomorrow night, or I'll be taping tomorrow night. It'll be on Wednesday, and I'll be talking about the conspiracy angle that's popular today.
Mm-hmm.
But I think we should go into the next few quotes, because when we look at cultures, which are based on language and artifacts, yet electricity is ESP. The blur and merger of ESP, how do you put verbal structures in relation to that? And so we're going to have some quotes here. We can go through about a page of them that show you the ground that's happening under the mixed corporate media effect of satellite, which makes all the older, bulky technologies, newspaper, TV, radio, pretty clumsy. All right?
Mm-hmm.
So let's go through. We're going to do quotes from... Okay, you do the quote, and at the end of it, I'll say where it's from. And then we'll go to the next quote, and you'll say where it's from. And they're all, I've organized them, they're all around the idea of ESP.
Hmm.
What is ESP? What is electronics in relation to ESP? But the first quote is a major one from Counterblast, which talks about a non-Jungian way of looking at the word archetype and the unconscious. This is the unconscious made by our second nature technological environments. So this quote comes first, and it's from Counterblast, the book, page 31. All right, and this book came out in 1969.
Technologies would seem to be the pushing of the arc. Hold on a second.
Hey, before you go into that, I just want to reread the satellite quote with my fluidity.
Okay.
So in light of what we're saying about the satellite, I'm going to reread the quote from the McLuhan-Doolin newsletter, January 69. He says, physically, the young seem to feel that the planet has become their stage. They want to act outside, in the street, on the campus. They have shifted their dramatic quest for identities and private opinions to the enactment of a new kind of group theater. Group theater, not private theater, actor role. It's done over 30. That's a group form. A wild orgy of long-term. Rich material for the hypothetical probe that the satellite environment offers to the planet itself as a new kind of theatrical stage. This rich material is to be found in the Walker Report to the National Commission on the Causes and Prevention of Violence. Now, you see, McLuhan is saying that his stuff is a hypothetical probe, that the satellite environment offers the planet itself as a new kind of theatrical stage or the content of the satellite environment. That's a hypothetical probe by McLuhan. But he didn't always present it that way. He presented it as if it was a fact, like he's saying in this next quote, which you're going to read from Counterblast.
Technologies would seem to be the pushing of the archetypal forms of the unconscious out into social consciousness. May this not help explain why technology as environment is typically unconscious? The interplay between environmental and content factors between old and new technologies seems to obtain in all fields whatever. In politics, the new conservatism has as its content the old liberalism. Every new technology requires a war in order to recover an image made by the old environment.
Yeah, like the young people, they usually try to forge a new image, but new environments threaten the adults who already have an established image, so they try to retrieve the former image, which is being scrapped by the demands on the sensory ratios, inner and outer, by the new technology and its environment, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we're juxtaposing what happens to youth and then what happens to adults, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
In this quote. And he's saying because technologies are the archetypal forms of the unconscious, and they're the extensions of that into social spaces, that is why no one knows the medium is the message. Until you get to the 20th century where we extend the unconscious, or the central nervous system, which we're unconscious of, but the fluidity of the electronic TV extension makes us aware a bit of the mechanical environment and how its effects were unconscious. Therefore, in the 60s, the rise of the shock that the planet was becoming polluted by industrial mechanical technologies. No one thought of that. as a general consensus in the 19th or early 20th century. But once we moved into a software environment, people started looking at the pollution of the old mechanical industrial environment, another aspect of the old becoming visible. But it was due to the rapidity of the TV environment and the electronic computer satellite environment that the changes people were put through, they began to see that something was unconscious going on. Something that was unconscious in the development of our progress. It's expressed in that phrase, technology is out of control, right? Technology is operating on its own. That's an expression of noticing that some levels of the environment are not controlled by humans anymore. Another way of saying that is that the effects of them are unconscious. But it was always rearview mirror. So in politics, the new conservatism, what we call the neocon today, they retrieved the idea of private identity as a counter to the group mandate of the tribal counterculture. So liberalism was the successful ideology from, say, 1800 to early part of the 20th century. It was an expression of the industrial, mobile, literate talent, literate worker. And they had the right to move around and get whatever job they want in the West. Then that becomes frowned upon by the group mandate of the TV effect on young baby boomers. And they don't want jobs. They want involvement, McLuhan said. They want tribal participation. So they didn't want the fragmented ideals of liberalism, so they grasped for Marxism, for spiritualism, all the different countercultural retrievals, anarchism. And so the new conservatism was a reaction to the law and order of the young involvement in the global theater, and so they retrieved the liberal, literate private identity and called it conservatism. You follow that?
Yep.
So in politics, the new conservatism has as its content the old liberalism. And this gets really funny because by the late 80s, the conservatives are calling their enemies liberals, even though they've retrieved liberalism. But again, it's in a new context, so all the categories get reversed and mixed up.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happens. The old categories of any culture get all topsy-turvied by a new environment, especially an electronic environment, which just wipes out the context for the literate ground.
Mm-hmm.
So every new technology requires a war in order to recover an image made by the old environment. So that was the Vietnam War or even the Korean War and all the little wars in the Middle East and in South America and in Africa. And in what we call the culture wars, that began in the 70s with the battle of the conservatives against the liberals, right? So that was a software image war.
Mm-hmm.
So that was another kind of war, not just a hardware war.
And then today we have this weird flip where we have the neoconservatives, which don't even seem to resonate to any elements of the old conservative party.
Right. There's something different. Some people say the neocon movement, and a lot of them, Cheney, these people were around in the 70s. What's his name? Netanyahu was propped up in the late 70s as a young man to help propagate the idea that the new world enemy was terrorism. He did that in the late 70s, sponsored by the CIA. You know, Netanyahu, the former president of Israel, now a contender again occasionally. He was a young student who went around in the late 70s under a false identity, setting up a think tank for raising money to counter the global terrorism. And then that became official in the Bush administration and was called the neocon environment. But I think you're onto something, that the neocon, the conservatives of the 70s were neocons, but there's something about the neocons today that even aren't limited to the goals of the Republican, traditional, moderate conservatives and maybe libertarian conservatives, or the rank and file of the Republican mandate is being violated even by something called neocons. But they represent something else.
But they are still, one element that seems to be the same is that they're still hawkish, aggressive,
yeah,
and kind of patriarchal.
Well, they hit their prime when we moved into the post. Now, this is my stuff, not McLuhan's. It's built on McLuhan, but we hit the post-information, neo-paleolithic wilderness world we're in now, where it's cavemen bashing each other, and supposedly men are stronger on that level, so the neocon aggressive political patriarchal mode that the neocon movement image represents is perfectly synced with the effects of the post-internet world we're in now. right?
Oh, yeah.
Its leader doesn't even bother communicating.
Mm-hmm. Although I heard today, one of these shows I was passing by, and somebody was commenting that Bush reads 60 books a year, you know, a book a week, which is kind of surprising because he has the image of being someone who's illiterate. But I don't know, maybe he does read a lot.
Okay, now that's interesting. I just heard today that Bush is in New York, and he's doing a big conference or big meeting with UN people tomorrow, but today he's here for a world literacy agenda. Now that fits totally into what I've said many times about Bush. He represents the archetype of literacy, kinetic industrial literacy that America was built on. And the archetypal institution is the White House. It's built on right-wing Bible people because that's the original medium for literacy in the United States, okay? That's the archetypal medium of literacy. It's really based around the newspaper. So you see, Bush, he does not read popular media. He does not engage with popular electronic media. But he does represent the literate meme. And so he's either it's true or not, but he represents someone reading books. Reading that many books is an obsolete activity. Reading books does not help you deal with perceiving the level of pen-ted management that I'm talking about that the real managers of society work on. They don't read books. They read memos. You haven't got time, but he has nothing else to do but to be a role player in that old image, so he pretends he's reading books or has nothing to do but to read books. And so he's concerned about world literacy. And the way they do it is they try to prop it up. They don't deal with the causes of the erosion of literacy and its vulnerability and how it's just an afterimage and a meme now. So Bush is not good at communicating. He's a literate person privately, represents literate values in the White House, but when he engages the Android meme or the post-literate world, he doesn't bother communicating in any stylistically resonant way. He just sticks his finger up at it, gives it the finger. And that's representing literate values, which have been marginalized in this as the 20th century unfolded, definitely now. So he's totally acting out what he should be doing. So it's not even important whether he reads the books or not. It's part of the image that he represents that has to be programmed.
Mm-hmm. Or he could just be a dope that got propped up because he is a dope.
Well, McLuhan in Take Today, the book that came out in 72, said the presidential surrogate. It's always an automated, no, he called it the automated or program presidential surrogate, is a superlative nobody. How is a nobody superlative? The superlative in acting out the script of the literate kinetic space of the White House. So the president is always a propped up image in the global theater. It's a natural program image, just as every other culture programs its culture back to its citizens. And there's another aspect here I want to say.
We don't know who
the automated presidential surrogate. He is not the president on the real level of solar government management. That's invisible. That's Big Brother.
Well, the decisions that he makes make a difference.
No, they don't. They have no effect on anything other than asserting the certain level of American industrial media or the oil consciousness in relation to other media. I mean, a large part of the world ignores the United States, and they don't need to deal with the United States. China, Africa, India, and Russia, they've got whole kinds of new trade agreements going on. They don't even bother with the United States. But when you're talking about countries, that's one thing. When you talk about the flow of digital money, which requires a small committee of people to manage that, those guys are intergalactic and international, and they're in China and Africa and Russia on the whole level of the digital economy. They're not on the planet. And that's where the real management is on that level of the digital chip body economy.
Mm.
You know, and nations and leaders have nothing to do with that.
Clinton didn't want to invade Iraq, and we didn't have a war. Bush wanted to, and we had a war. So one man made a big difference.
Why do you think Bush caused that?
You
don't think it was the international oil elite that did that?
Well, maybe if they were the ones that had something to do with electing him and his administration.
Yeah, they did. Bush
but his
biggest war chest when he was running for president that ever happened in history. I mean, you know, in 1999 to 2000, when he was running for president, he had billions and billions of dollars going into him. He was the one that was linked into networks, as most people think. The Bush family represents the oil oligarchy. But it's not that similar. They are part of that history, but there's a lot more other people involved. and you don't even know who they are.
Yeah.
So it's an international identity crisis, act out by an old industrial structure that's led to the present problems in the Middle East. There's all kinds of other things going on all over the world. It's only because American media focuses on the Middle East war as a dramatic identity quest.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's in the operation, the Middle East war.
Yeah.
It doesn't even matter that, you know, from the chip party level, it doesn't even
matter that
the Americans are screwing up. People are saying, well, why would George Bush make such a big mistake? Well, it's not Bush. It's not the factors that are presented to you. It's environmental landscapes, technological archetypes that are battling it out.
You know, I heard this guy on the radio. He's what do you call those guys that sign up and go to war on private contracts? Not militia men.
Mercenary.
Yeah, he was a mercenary. He was traveling around with mercenaries and doing documentaries and stuff like that.
Who are doing most of the fighting in the Middle East? You know, it's all privatized.
Yeah, I know. Over 50% of the fighting is being done by private.
And they're better paid.
Yeah.
So those that are over there under national government auspices don't even have enough money to buy their helmets and all that stuff.
Yeah.
They're working for a 19th century hologram, whereas the international corporations that are involved with the oil conscious that need that situation in the Middle East, they funded their own armies.
Yeah, these mercenaries are making $500 a day.
Yeah.
What are our troops making? Not $500 a day.
Now, just that effect, which we've known for ever since the war started, just that effect should tell you that your media that tells you live in New York City or Oregon or United States and that you have soldiers, just that is a total ridiculous distraction program for local consumption for those that believe they are a local phenomenon and don't need body and chip body and are global and intergalactic. Just the fact of the mercenaries are the majority better-paid armies who are over there getting paid and probably don't care if the war doesn't achieve any peace.
Yeah.
You know, so
this guy, one
can, if you know McLuhan, then you can put it into a context, you know.
This guy pointed out what a puny operation Bin Laden is. He said the guy's got like 100, maybe 135, you know, core people working with him. And, you know, they were able to orchestrate this Twin Tower thing with whatever help and money that they had from other organizations, but they're not. Him and his group. They're not an army. They don't have any real military might, and yet.
Yeah, but you know who does have the military might?
Who?
The Muslim Brotherhood. I mean, Bin Laden is an extension of the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, there's a powerful organization that's been around since 1928, and it's the Muslim Brotherhood that their religious goals and laws make them very amenable to the chip body economists because they believe in private property. And so the Americans say, Bush is over there to stop the terrorists, but the terrorists are taking over the governments. Hamas in Palestine, the Shiites in Iraq. Well, how come these people who are not Democrats are taking over? Well, they're part of the Muslim Brotherhood Network, which believes in doing business in the way the so-called neocon international corporation wants to do business. So it's not a disadvantage that these Muslim Brotherhood, Islamo-fascist, Nazi cult people are taking over these countries. They're totally into American capitalism in their terms. They believe in private property. So there's a simple fact there that throws light on a lot of the stuff. What were you saying that made me say that?
Apparently they don't believe in capitalism.
They don't believe in Western banks. They believe in their banks, and they believe in people contributing in their business life to the religious icon from the medieval ages. So they're tribally retrieving their form of visual space, which is manuscript culture, but it's an audio tactile form of manuscript culture, not the print form of Western religion, which is Catholicism and Protestantism and fundamentalism or Baptist derivatives. They don't have the printing press effect that the West had, but they're more religious than.
Well, they relate to the Quran and the scriptures and
the
all that.
The manuscript. That's not a printing press.
Oh, that's true.
It is now, but the ideals, they're not illiterate people into reading novels. They only read the Bible and pray three times a day or whatever it is, five times a day. You know, they're living in the 12th century as most people iconically and on a cartoon level perceive the Islamofascist is doing. But they're just trying to preserve their meme, just preserving his American meme by waking up 6 a year and walking around pretending there's the United States. And these are technological landscapes or archetypes of the previous social unconscious, which are now and therefore fought over. Everybody's preserving their past underneath the conditions, and let's go into them. Let's do the next five quotes on the global ESP, or tactile blur. First quote from McLuhan's Explorations number 8, which came out in 1957. You know, he did the Explorations Journal with Dick Carpenter. Dick Carpenter was the editor from 53 to 57, but the number 8 issue was done by McLuhan himself. Ted didn't do this issue, and so he has all kinds of essays by McLuhan, little short essays, and one of them was called Electronics as ESP. This is 1957, so one has to meditate on how electronics is extrasensory perception, and it's item 3 in a list of, I don't know, about 30 items in the book, the issue of Explorations number 8 called Verbi-Vocal-Visual Explorations. Then we go to the next quote from Counterblast, page 23. The content of writing is speech, but the content of speech is mental dance, nonverbal ESP. Now, when you live in a tactile electric environment, you're in the content of speech. You're in a world of mental dance and nonverbal ESP. How does a culture built on a manuscript?